I almost dread to get into the car and go home with Paul McGee, who kids me mercilessly and who will say to me as soon as he gets in the car, "Well, Bob, it was poignant to be present on the day when you began to slip and go downhill." So I want to tell him now and tell the rest of you that it may not be a sign of slippage. It may only be a long-standing kind of habit with me. I remember many years ago in another church, I wanted to introduce a visitor who was an extremely close friend with whom I took walks about 3 times a week. I had been doing that for at least 15 years. Some of you were present that day, and I started to call his name after mentioning that he was there, and I couldn't think of it. So I thought, well, I have to have another sentence. So I said, he's a remarkable young man who's lived here in Wichita for quite some time. Couldn't think of it. He and his family have been very important to my family. Couldn't think of it. Said one more sentence and decided that I was going to have to give up and say I had forgotten, and it popped into my head. I did not have a bulletin this morning, so when I wondered what was to happen next, it was no act. I really didn't know. I want to answer a question. Quickly, somebody walked in the door and said, "Are we going to have that from now on?" Looking at the picture. So it was apparently clear from the moment you came in that I'm doing at least one thing I've never done before in all the years I have known some of you. Actually, there are two things different. One is that I'm going to base an entire sermon on symbolism. And the other is that I'm going to make use of a visual aid or a prop, the very thing which has sometimes embarrassed me from pulpits. You know what I mean, the umbrella that is lifted up to the audience as an object lesson in God's providential care, how he shields us from the storm, or the shepherd's crook to illustrate the 23rd Psalm, or the little oil lamps for which the 5 foolish maidens in the parable hadn't kept enough oil. Fine, I used to say, for children's sermons, a little obvious for adults. But life is too short for inflexible consistency. One ought to be somewhat unpredictable, so I have broken radically with my own custom. I have a picture in front of you which, when I've talked about it, will not, I hope, embarrass either you or me. But before we get to that, let's think about symbolism in general for a moment. There is an enormous amount of number symbolism, as most of you know, in the Bible. It doesn't mean much to us anymore, except for a little lingering triskaidekaphobia, fear of the number 13. Some hotels will not number a 13th floor. Some people will not stay in room 13. People in biblical times carried it much further, so that both Jewish and Christian history are full of fascination with the symbolism of numbers. For example, 3 is a sacred number in Christian history, and so is 9, because it is the sum of 3 times 3. The great Italian Catholic poet Dante had 9 circles in hell, purgatory, and paradise. His Satan in the bottom pit of hell had 3 faces, and on it went, this curious game, and everybody understood it. Well, it should be pointed out to you that we have a little of this number symbolism involved in some of the aspects of our church. We have the number 9 in our street address, and rather interestingly, we have it 3 times. 9209 East 29th. So we have a trinity of nines. But there is more. The number 7 is also a very special sacred number in biblical writing, the number of wholeness, of completeness, of perfection. So listen to our phone number. After the mandatory 685 for this region, the last 4 digits are 7733. Play with it any way you like. I now promise never to mention it again. Now that's one kind of symbolism. There is another kind. One day when the tiles were being installed in the bathrooms in this building, I had a brief talk with the man doing the work. He seemed curious about the church and wondered who I was. I told him and answered some of his questions. And then I said something about the off-white color of the tile he was using. And he said, well, at least it's not pure white. There's so much purity in this church, I'm not sure a guy like me could stand it. Now, he hadn't met any of you yet. So he was talking not about moral character, but about the symbolism of white walls and woodwork and pews. And he was right to link white with purity, although it also stands for innocence, for goodness, for safety and security. I decided that afternoon that in these first few weeks of our existence in this place filled with light and filled with that absence of color which is white, we should talk about how far back that symbolism goes and how it was born. Certainly a long time before the Bible was written, white had already been linked with purity. So it was easy for Daniel to speak of how something should be purified and made white, and for the book of Revelation to describe the great white throne of God and the white robes worn by the redeemed, and to quote the Lord's promise that the redeemed are to walk with me in white. Wash me, the familiar hymn goes, and I shall be whiter than snow. So where did it come from, this equation between white and purity, between light as a symbol of good things and darkness as the symbol of ignorance and evil? The obvious answer to that is probably the right one. You think of primitive man huddling in the darkness, unprotected, unable to see what animals or enemies are waiting for his campfire to fade, all the features of the bright, familiar world blotted out, bushes become bears, stumps turned into giants from the tribe over the hill. Think how many times people must have waited in terror through the night, hoping to make it to morning when the dark would go wherever it goes and the light would fill up the world. So darkness became the symbol for fear and evil, and light for hope and goodness. And it could have been, I think, the first example of symbolism in the history of mankind. No wonder the creation story, in defiance of logic, fills the world with light even before it has God create the sun. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And across all those centuries, I can still feel the passion in that great moment of lyric poetry, "Let there be light." And because there is light, there is color and form, the hills stand up, one sees the beloved face, the blue sky by day, the bright moon by night. A much later poet named John Milton, who went blind in the middle of his life to the glory of sight, wrote his own commentary to that opening verse in Genesis. "Hail, holy light, offspring of heaven firstborn. Not man first, but light." Long before Milton, long even before the Genesis poet, light was a symbol for life. In the great alluvial plains between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, where man lived so early in his history, it was when the sun came back from the dark of winter that the seed sprouted and the flocks brought forth their young. The day stretched out, the light lingered, and families rejoiced. Without that light, no life. And without that light, no abiding sense of safety. The primitive fear of the dark has not wholly left us. We lie in bed, ill or worried, and feel the dark like a dreadful weight. There is hardly anyone present who has not known this, and we long desperately for the light to come. It won't seem as bad in the daylight, someone tells us. And so, "Morning Has Broken" is not just a lovely song. It is the joyous recollection of those times in our lives when after darkness came the dawn, so fresh and sweet and welcome that it was like a new creation. We can only reach out to the ultimate mysteries from the ones we know, which is why the light is our best symbol for the realities we believe in beyond our sight, which is why Dante, coming to the end of the greatest poetic journey man has ever taken, through the reaches of hell and purgatory and paradise, climaxed his epic story with a vision of God as a great, glorious, pulsing light. For him, God is not simply the author of light. God is light. Not so long ago, of course, before science began to teach us differently, everybody thought that the light we see was everywhere, that it went on and on beyond the blue sky, so that if somehow you could travel to the stars, even there would be alternating light and dark. Now we know better. We know, as this incredible photograph tells us, that the earth hangs in a world of darkness, a blue and white sapphire suspended in the velvet black, in a darkness that goes on and on forever, unbearably cold and alien, so that the eye wants to come back home, keeps being drawn to that beautiful globe suspended in the well of night. Now, what one person feels may leave another unmoved, but I shall tell you anyway that I think this is the most astonishing single picture of the 20th century. This fragile ornament of cloud and sea and land, hanging in the immense and lonely skies, half in light, half in darkness. 100 times in imagination, I've stood with the awestruck astronomer 230,000 miles from home and thought, can there be a fairer sight in all the universe than this place called Earth, gathering light in a world of darkness? I understand why one of the space travelers, looking across the bleak and barren landscape of the moon, chose to read from Genesis how the world was void and darkness lay over the abyss until God said, let there be light. Simple, magnificent poetry from an unknown human being who had never seen a picture like this, but was awed, even in his ignorance, by the mystery and blessing of light. We should have sent a poet to the moon, someone to capture the feelings of those who saw, as no men had ever seen. His words might have been more useful in the end than all the facts that were scrupulously recorded and brought back. Fortunately, back on Earth, we had a poet, a fine poet, who saw the pictures they took and had the words for how they must have felt. The words belong to Archibald MacLeish. For the first time in all of time, men have seen Earth. Seen it not as continents or oceans from the little distance of 100 miles, but seen it from the depths of space. Seen it whole and round and beautiful and small, as even Dante had never dreamed of seeing it. And seeing it so, one question came to the minds of those who looked at it. Is it inhabited? They said to each other and laughed. And then they did not laugh. What came to their minds was the life on that little, lonely, floating planet, that tiny raft in the enormous, empty night. Is it inhabited? I hope some of you will look at the picture and not at me as I read his final sentence. In my judgment, one of the most beautiful and hopeful sentences ever written. To see Earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful, in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on Earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who know now they are truly brothers. I'm not so lost in this beautiful rhetoric, this wistful hope, that I do not know what a close-up view would show me. Zoom across the thousands of miles of darkness, pierce the clouds, focus on Sikhs murdering Hindus, on landmines made like toys, especially for children in Afghanistan. Focus on terrorism and apartheid and a world blind with blood, and it gets harder to say the words, riders on earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who know now they are truly brothers. We saw the picture some 20 years ago, and we forgot it. Some, of course, never saw it at all. In a world where for millions a picture like this would be an unimaginable luxury. But there were other millions who did see it, stopped to gaze for a moment, and put it out of mind. I hoped when I put the picture in front of you this morning that it would be for you as it is for me more than a picture. It is a theological statement. The highest poetry of the Bible transformed into a 20th century miracle that no biblical poet could have imagined. We shot our shining metal arrow into infinity, and we saw as never before the stark and terrifying contrast between the light and the eternal darkness. We found answers to some of our questions. What is it like on the surface of the moon? How does the earth look from out there? What are the elements in moon rocks? But the great earth mysteries still tease us, as they always have. Why am I here? What should I do with my life? Is there any ultimate reality beyond the reach of this speckled mote on which I live? The only answer so far is the answer of faith. The man in whose name we met this morning thought there was an ultimate reality beyond the things we can see and measure. And even now, when our space shuttles are grounded, we look at this picture, this amazing moment in our history, when technology became a handmaiden to poetry. And we hear the confident claim of one of the friends of Jesus. The light shines on in the dark, and the darkness has never conquered it. Whatever the hope of others may be, that is ours. We who are the people to whom he paid the greatest of all compliments when he called us the children of light.